contract theory in somewhat pure form. Aside, of course, from his American inheritors, those who sort of build on Locke or Locke-like conceptions. But after Locke, or after the Lockeans, I suppose you could say, and for our purposes, the Lockeans come down to about the time of the Declaration of Independence, you see. After the Lockeans, there's going to be a tendency to attack social contract conceptions. And with them, to attack many of the bases for individualism as a political philosophy, which are embodied in social contract theory. I think at the beginning of this term, you remember, I drew a chart of some sort in my inimitable style, pointing out how you reach the apex, so to speak, of individualist philosophies in the 18th century, and then you begin to get an onslaught on those philosophies. How are they attacked, then, will be the subject, you see, the very many faceted forms of attack in topic 7. This will occupy us the rest of the term. In other words, we'll be getting into attacks by the historicists, attacks even by social contract theorists like Rousseau, who is often said to be a transition figure from social contract to non-social contract ways of thinking. Attacks from Hegel, you see. And then the continuation of Hegel in Marx, with whom we're going to conclude. Marx will have roots in some of the ideas of the contract theorists, but in many respects will begin to repudiate them, you see, building upon the Hegelian structure. And so then we get the birth of modern socialism toward the end of our discussion this term. And we'll also be bringing in, of course, the rise of what we call economic science, the dismal science, as it is sometimes called, and its impact on political theory, on the image we have of the whole area of politics. This, in other words, is where we'll be going then after Monday. On Monday, I want us to reserve Monday for a continuing discussion of Locke, and particularly the impact of Locke on the 18th century. He has a many-faceted impact, you see. I want us to discuss that question, and also the criticism of Locke, how we would proceed to attack his conceptions. I'd like for you to pay particular attention to the doctrine of majority rule. How would you proceed to criticize the doctrine of majority rule, which we associate with the system of Locke so often? We'll be touching on the doctrine of majority rule today, but we won't be able to get into any of the criticisms that might be leveled at. See, majority rule is so often taken for granted in modern politics, particularly in so-called democratic politics, that we never question it. We never ask, what is the justification for majority rule? How would you defend it? Almost no one ever says how he would defend it, he or she would defend it. And yet it's a very difficult doctrine to defend, you see. So I want us to raise the level of our consciousness, as the jargon is, on that question, this whole question of majority rule. Another question, of course, will be a criticism of Locke's theory of property, into which we're going today, but we won't have a chance really to summarize the criticisms that can be directed at Locke's theory of property. So I hope you keep those two kinds of problems in mind and be prepared to raise questions or to offer criticisms of your own. Now, when we are ended yesterday, let me see if I can remember where we were. We were beginning, you will remember, we started dealing with Locke, All the Human Understanding, his essay concerning the human understanding. And we tried to compare, you will remember, Locke's conception of how we know with Hobbes's conception of how we know. We suggested that in Locke's conception, the sensations that constitute the basis for all knowledge, and hence his empiricist view of knowledge, those sensations come through the cabinet door of our psyches, through the lower part of the door, where it isn't completely closed, where there's a big crack in the door. It's still a dark closet, but they come in, and as Locke puts it, they lodge themselves in the psyche. He doesn't say use the term psyche, in the mind, whatever the mind is. We always use these terms, you know, we really don't know what they are. But anyway, we have to use something. And then you'll remember he argued that all knowledge is built on these sensations, and hence we sometimes call him a sensationalist as well as an empiricist. Even moral knowledge, he says, is derived from sensation, because nature's God, that's another expression of Locke, nature's God has endowed us with two ways of grasping good and evil, that is, the two indicators of good and evil. Those indicators are pleasure and pain. And so, when we feel pleasure through these sensations, the pleasure guides us to conceptions of the good. The pain guides us to conceptions of evil. And thus, moral conceptions upon which political views will have to be built, themselves are derived from sensations. And the result is that men in a state of nature are not completely bound up in themselves because of the partially open closet door, you see, are not completely bound up in themselves as with Hobbes. We suggested yesterday, as with Hobbes, from a social and political point of view, with Hobbes, the closet has to be battered down by fear and threat of violence from our neighbor. Although he doesn't put it this way, but this is what he seems to be saying. For Locke, there is a certain recognition of others, even in the state of nature. And we quoted Locke's statement that men and women in the state of nature recognize that they are the workmanship, to use Locke's conception, the workmanship of an all-wise and all-powerful maker, M-A-K-E-R. Later, Locke will write a very interesting essay on religion, which he calls the reasonableness of Christianity. That's the key word, the reasonableness. Not the fact that it's revealed, if it is, but it's reasonable. And so in the state of nature, as we said yesterday, then, we recognize ourselves as creatures of God. And as creatures of God, we, generally speaking, respect one another's life. Not because we fear our neighbor, but because we know through the law of nature, which we apprehend, or through the laws of nature, which we apprehend in the natural state, that we ought to respect our neighbor. Remember, in Hobbes's conception, the laws of nature are maxims of prudence. which somehow are derived from fear of our neighbor, fear that he may do us to death. In Locke's conception, as we concluded yesterday, by contrast, the laws of nature are apprehended directly, and the laws of nature are closely connected with our reasonable apprehension in the state of nature of nature's God. Nature and nature's God, remember. Where else do you find those expressions? Nature and nature's God.
Declaration of Independence.
Declaration of Independence. Nature and nature's God. You see, Jefferson lists them right out of Locke. And remember, we said yesterday also, Locke uses the expression in his essay concerning human understanding, a constant determination to a pursuit of happiness. Jefferson lifts that out, puts it in the Declaration of Independence, combines it with nature and nature's God, you see, and gets the framework then for the Declaration of Independence. Now it is then, in the state of nature, then the state of nature is considerably different from Hobbes' state of nature. And the people who are in it, you see, have this rational apprehension from the beginning of the laws of nature and of nature's God. So that we do not respect our neighbor's life because we ultimately fear him, but we respect it as an end in itself, that he's like us, we're fellow creatures of nature's God. Yeah.
Did you say that the laws of nature, that the reason Locke says we know the laws of nature is from a principle of pleasure and pain?
Well, that's a good question. Why do you raise that question, Mindy? Go ahead.
Well, using a reductionist point of view, I would then say, well, if it's pleasure to live and pain to die, then couldn't we say that Hobbes and Locke are saying the same thing, and that the pleasure is, you know, that we derive pleasure from living by not being killed by our neighbor.
There's no question what Hobbes is, the hedonist, as we say, too. You see, he builds his conception of good on hedonism, a hedonistic conception. There's no question about that. I think the difference is that in the beginning, in Hobbes, all we know is that we want to dominate and preserve our own lives. We have no good hand about our neighbors, you see, in Hobbes. Until we feel our neighbor's about to kill us. And then we say, well, we better go easy. We better develop some maxims of prudence so that we can get the best possible deal from our neighbor without risking his killing us. Dominate him as much as possible, but at the same time prevent him from killing us, because he's always intent on killing us. Now the point is that in Locke's state of nature, the basic paradigm or the basic framework in the state of nature is that we never are in a state where we are constantly wanting to kill our neighbors. That's a premise that Hobbes says is the most primitive premise. Do you see the difference here? In other words, Hobbes's man at the primitive state of nature is not concerned about others at all until he begins to fear them. And fear, as I read Locke, does not play a role in the analysis of man does not play a primary role. We're going to see it plays a role. And the debate about Hobbes is, or Locke, is how much of a role fear will play in the state of nature. But it's not a primary role as it is but with Hobbes. Although you're quite right in saying that both of them say, I have a right by nature to my life. They're both saying that. The difference is that Locke's man says, you have a right by nature to your life too. And you do, because both of us are creatures of a common maker. We're united to each other in that way, that we can apprehend this right from the beginning. an expression in my country, 'tis of thee, that sometimes perhaps you haven't thought about, that I think bears on Locke, with this whole kind of paradigm that Locke is dealing with. You remember, it says, our Father's God to thee, author of what? Liberty. What does that mean? What would you say that means? Now, I haven't asked you to consider that, but how does this relate to Locke? Author of liberty. Isn't that a funny usage of the term author? What's meant by it? Now, I'm springing this question on you, but how would you explicate it, as we say? How would you interpret what that term liberty means in this context? God as author of liberty.
Well, from what you just said, it's Locke's basic premise that everyone has a right to their freedom in their
yes.
life.
Author comes from the same root as authority. God is the authority for liberty. Right from the very beginning. He originates, so to speak, he's the beginning of liberty. Because he created, as a maker of man, man be free.
Would you say that Hobbes, on the other hand, does he think that liberty comes from society, the contract of society, or does it come from each individual? Is it drawn out of each individual? It's not something that's set over him.
Well, each of us has, in Hobbes's view, as I would interpret him, each of us has complete liberty in nature, in the state of nature, to both liberty and power, to control his neighbor, or even if he has the power, to kill him, you see.
Is that the nature of a natural law, or is that something that is just maybe like Stirner, unique in each individual, and each individual does it himself?
Well, it's a natural right. It's a right that we have in nature because of our egoistic being, you see, with which we begin. That each of us demands in nature supreme power, supreme domination, and life for himself. He's not concerned about his neighbor, you see, at the most primitive level. He has to be shocked into concern by fearing his neighbor. So he begins to love his neighbor, in quotes, because he fears his neighbor. Remember the paradigm that we suggested before. In other words, Hobbes would say, I suppose, that we never perform an act that we would call altruistic out of our sheer altruism, concern for others. We always have in the back of our minds or in our subconscious, let's say, a Carnegie Medal for heroism, as we rush to save one from drowning. We can never be unconcerned, in a sense. We're always acting in accordance with maxims of prudence. You remember, Hobbes also says, I think we quoted him, if you go to a cocktail party or to some other kind of party, beer party or beer bust or a marijuana party, whatever it is, doesn't matter, you're not interested in other people for themselves. You never can be. You're interested in them only insofar as you can get the better of them. Now, you try to disguise this by all sorts of methods, of course. You say, well, old buddy. Or you pretend to love them, you see, because you fear them at the same time. So you have to put on this act, you see. But well, you remember I quoted Hobbes as saying that when you laugh, the basic reason you laugh is because something bad has happened to your neighbor. And you take pleasure in his discomfiture. There's no such thing as a pure altruistic act if you accept the Hobbesian version of man and woman. Now, let's go back to Locke's conception, then, if that distinction between the two is relatively clear. We have our man, then, in a state of nature. What's your judgment after you've read Locke? Does Locke believe that the state of nature is an historical state before we get into the nature of the state of nature? Did it actually exist historically or not? All of you read the second treatise now, and how would you judge that question? Well, he does seem to suggest that it is, it can be, in existence. He cites, for example, certain tribes supposedly in Brazil, in the New World, which presumably do not have what he calls a politic or civil society. That is to say, there's no superordination and subordination. See, this seems to be the principle that he uses to differentiate a civil society from a politic society. And so he suggests that maybe it actually exists, at least. Hobbes, by contrast, doesn't seem to postulate it as an historical state. It's a postulate, literally a postulate, to account for the way men behave, for Hobbes. But it does not necessarily exist historically. For Locke, it may, although Locke is a little bit fuzzy about that question. Yes.
What was the question?
No. Well, let's look a little bit more in detail now what the state of nature means, what it means to be in a state of nature. First of all, it's not centrally a state of war. That's one important point to make about Locke. It's not centrally a state of war. Now, that's already been implied in our discussion here of the contrast between Hobbes and Locke, you see. You are not in a state of war with your neighbor constantly, as in Hobbes' conceptions. And this is even without a politic society or civil societies. You are sufficiently aware of your neighbor's rights to be able to make contracts with him, you see. Even at the most primitive level, you make particular contracts with him, and you generally observe those contracts. That is, you don't need a judge to enforce them. You enforce them yourselves. Each of you is an executive, as Locke puts it, in a state of nature. Now, sometimes the contracts are broken, to be sure, but generally speaking, they're observed. Sometimes in the state of nature, we kill one another in what Locke calls our passionate heats. How do you like that expression? In our passionate heats, we sometimes strike our neighbor when we're irrational, you see. In other words, we forget that one of the laws of nature is that we respect our neighbor as an end in himself because he's a common creature of a common maker, nature's God. But occasionally we'll, in our passionate heats, we'll strike him. Now, what are the rights of nature that we can apprehend in terms of the laws of nature? Well, Locke tends to say that the rights of nature are subsumed under this difficult word, property. And I ask you to meditate on Locke's view of property for today. He quotes the 115th Psalm, the 16th verse. In the 16th verse of the 115th Psalm, the psalmist says, The heavens are the Lord's heavens. Now here's the crucial phrase. But the earth he has given to the sons of men. The heavens are the Lord's heavens, but the earth he has given to the sons of men. Now Locke interprets that second part of the 16th verse as meaning that all the earth has been given to the human race collectively in nature. It belongs to humanity as a whole. In other words, humanity at the most primitive state of nature, humanity as a whole has property in all the natural resources of the earth. The animal resources, the birds, the beasts, the blue sky, I suppose, because you view it from the earth, you're standing on the earth when you view it, everything on the earth is collective humanity, you see, at the most primitive state of nature. The term property now then is going to be one of the crucial words here. If you look up property in the dictionary, one of its connotations is particular characteristic. That is, we speak of chemical properties, don't we? In classes in chemistry. We speak of a stone as having certain properties, roughly certain peculiar characteristics. It's blue, or it's many-sided, or it's round, you see. We use property in this sense of the term. Another sense, which is closely related to this expression of the term property, is our own, whatever is our own. That doesn't take you very far, but it has a similar connotation, you see, in the sense that one of my properties is brown eyes. One of my properties, I'm 6'3¾". Another of my properties is, I suppose you could say, I don't like to be crowded. Characteristics that you associate peculiarly with a given thing, a rock or a stone or a person, or the human race. In this sense, man's potential rationality, as Aristotle talked about it, would be regarded as what? A property of human beings, their potential rationality. When Locke spoke of, when Aristotle spoke of man as political, what would that be in these terms? Man is political. Well, that would be another property of man, you see. You see, a characteristic, a peculiar characteristic that differentiates him, presumably from the angels, on the one hand, and the beasts from the other. Remember those early sections in Aristotle's Politics where he deals with this problem of man's relationship to the gods on the one hand and the beasts on the other. But what would be some of the properties of God then, using this term? Now here again, I didn't throw this question to you originally, but you know about God, all you've experienced God, so give me some of the properties of God. Omnipotence would be a property of God. Anything else, presumably? Is what?
Infinite.
Infinity in some sense, yes. Any other properties of God?
Unmoving.
Unmoving. He's not moved by any outside force except himself or herself. You're one right.